Legendary doesn't happen by chance. It happens because it's what BetMGM does. Sign up for BetMGM and check out all the exciting new ways you can make this pro football season unforgettable. Shoot your shot with same-game parlays. Call your plays like a pro with live betting. Or bet on a market you didn't know existed thanks to BetMGM Originals. You'll be on the edge of your seat from the very first snap, no matter what type of fan you are. Earn BetMGM rewards points on every bet. Take advantage of football offers found nowhere else, like a second chance on a first touchdown bet. And keep an eye out for rewards dropping in your account throughout the season. Never settle for the ordinary. Sign up today. BetMGM. Make it legendary.
BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. Specific promotional offers are not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text OPENY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. Three Short Works by Gustave Flaubert. The Legend of St. Julian the Hospitaller. Chapter 2. The Crime. He joined a horde of adventurers who were passing through the place. He learned what it was to suffer hunger, thirst, sickness, and filth. He grew accustomed to the din of battles and to the sight of dying men. The wind tanned his skin. His limbs became hardened through contact with armour, and as he was very strong and brave, temperate and of good counsel, he easily obtained command of a company. At the outset of a battle, he would electrify his soldiers by a motion of his sword. He would climb the walls of a citadel with a knotted rope at night, rocked by a storm, while sparks of fire clung to his cuirass, and molten lead and boiling tar poured from the battlements. Often a stone would break his shield. Bridges crowded with men gave way under him. Once, by turning his mace, he rid himself of 14 horsemen. He defeated all those who came forward to fight him on the field of honour, and more than a score of times it was believed that he had been killed. However, thanks to divine protection, he always escaped, for he shielded orphans, widows, and aged men. When he caught sight of one of the latter walking ahead of him, he would call to him to show his face, as if he feared that he might kill him by mistake. All sorts of intrepid men gathered under his leadership, fugitive slaves, peasant rebels, and penniless bastards. He then organized an army which increased so much that he became famous and was in great demand. He succoured in turn the Dauphin of France, the King of England, the Templars of Jerusalem, the General of the Parths, the Negus of Abyssinia, and the Emperor of Calicut. He fought against Scandinavians covered with fish scales, against Negroes mounted on red asses and armed with shields made of hippopotamus hide, against gold-coloured Indians, who wielded great shining swords above their heads. He conquered the troglodytes and the cannibals. He travelled through regions so torrid that the heat of the sun would set fire to the hair on one's head. He journeyed through countries so glacial that one's arms would fall from the body. And he passed through places where the fogs were so dense that it seemed like being surrounded by phantoms. Republics in trouble consulted him. When he conferred with ambassadors, he always obtained unexpected concessions. Also, if a monarch behaved badly, he would arrive on the scene and rebuke him. He freed nations. He rescued queens sequestered in towers. It was he, and no other, that killed the serpent of Milan and the dragon of Oberbierbach. Now the Emperor of Occitania, having triumphed over the Spanish Mussulmans, had taken the sister of the Caliph of Cordova as a concubine, and had had one daughter by her, whom he brought up in the teachings of Christ. But the Caliph, feigning that he wished to become converted, made him a visit, and brought with him a numerous escort. He slaughtered the entire garrison, and threw the emperor into a dungeon, and treated him with great cruelty in order to obtain possession of his treasures. Julian went to his assistance, destroyed the army of infidels, laid siege to the city, slew the caliph, chopped off his head, and threw it over the fortifications like a cannonball. As a reward for so great a service, the emperor presented him with a large sum of money in baskets, but Julian declined it. Then the emperor, thinking that the amount was not sufficiently large, offered him 3/4 of his fortune, and on meeting a second refusal, proposed to share his kingdom with his benefactor. But Julian only thanked him for it, and the emperor felt like weeping with vexation at not being able to show his gratitude, when he suddenly tapped his forehead and whispered a few words in the ear of one of his courtiers. The tapestry curtains parted, and a young girl appeared. Her large black eyes shone like two soft lights. A charming smile parted her lips. Her curls were caught in the jewels of her half-opened bodice, and the grace of her youthful body could be divined under the transparency of her tunic. She was small and quite plump, but her waist was slender. Julian was absolutely dazzled, all the more since he had always led a chaste life. So he married the emperor's daughter, and received at the same time a castle she had inherited from her mother. And when the rejoicings were over, he departed with his bride, after many courtesies had been exchanged on both sides. The castle was of Moorish design, in white marble, erected on a promontory, and surrounded by orange trees. Terraces of flowers extended to the shell-strewn shores of a beautiful bay. Behind the castle spread a fan-shaped forest. The sky was always blue, and the trees were swayed in turn by the ocean breeze and by the winds that blew from the mountains that closed the horizon. Light entered the apartments through the incrustations of the walls. High reed-like columns supported the ceiling of the cupolas, decorated in imitation of stalactites. Fountains played in the spacious halls. The courts were inlaid with mosaic. There were festooned partitions and a great profusion of architectural fancies, and everywhere reigned a silence so deep that the swish of a sash or the echo of a sigh could be distinctly heard. Julian now had renounced war. Surrounded by a peaceful people, he remained idle, receiving every day a throng of subjects who came and knelt before him and kissed his hands in Oriental fashion. Clad in sumptuous garments, he would gaze out of the window and think of his past exploits, and wish that he might again run in the desert in pursuit of ostriches and gazelles, hide among the bamboos to watch for leopards, ride through forests filled with rhinoceroses, climb the most inaccessible peaks in order to have a better aim at the eagles, and fight the polar bears on the icebergs of the northern sea. Sometimes in his dreams he fancied himself like Adam in the midst of paradise, surrounded by all the beasts. By merely extending his arm he was able to kill them. or else they filed past him in pairs, by order of size, from the lions and the elephants to the ermines and the ducks, as on the day they entered Noah's ark. Hidden in the shadow of a cave, he aimed unerring arrows at them. Then came others and still others, until he awoke, wild-eyed. Princes, friends of his, invited him to their meets, but he always refused their invitations because he thought that by this kind of penance he might possibly avert the threatened misfortune. It seemed to him that the fate of his parents depended on his refusal to slaughter animals. He suffered because he could not see them, and his other desire was growing well-nigh unbearable. In order to divert his mind, his wife had dancers and jugglers come to the castle. She went abroad with him in an open litter. At other times, stretched out on the edge of a boat, they watched for hours the fish disport themselves in the water, which was as clear as the sky. Often she playfully threw flowers at him, or nestled at his feet. She played melodies on an old mandolin. Then, clasping her hands on his shoulder, she would inquire tremulously, "What troubles thee, my dear lord?" He would not reply, or else he would burst into tears, but at last, one day, he confessed his fearful dread. His wife scorned the idea and reasoned wisely with him. Probably his father and mother were dead, and even if he should ever see them again, through what chance, to what end, would he arrive at this abomination? Therefore, his fears were groundless, and he should hunt again. Julian listened to her and smiled, but he could not bring himself to yield to his desire. One August evening, when they were in their bedchamber, she having just retired, and he being about to kneel in prayer, he heard the yelping of a fox and light footsteps under the window, and he thought he saw things in the dark that looked like animals. The temptation was too strong. He seized his quiver. His wife appeared astonished. "I am obeying you," quoth he, "and I shall be back at sunrise." However, she feared that some calamity would happen, but he reassured her and departed, surprised at her illogical moods. A short time afterwards, a page came to announce that two strangers desired, in the absence of the lord of the castle, to see its mistress at once. Soon a stooping old man and an aged woman entered the room. Their coarse garments were covered with dust, and each leaned on a stick. They grew bold enough to say that they brought Julian news of his parents. She leaned out of the bed to listen to them, but after glancing at each other, the old people asked her whether he ever referred to them, and if he still loved them. "Oh, yes," she said. Then they exclaimed, "We are his parents," and they sat themselves down, for they were very tired. But there was nothing to show the young wife that her husband was their son. They proved it by describing to her the birthmarks he had on his body. Then she jumped out of bed, called a page, and ordered that a repast be served to them. But although they were very hungry, they could scarcely eat, and she observed surreptitiously how their lean fingers trembled whenever they lifted their cups. They asked 100 questions about their son, and she answered each one of them, but she was careful not to refer to the terrible idea that concerned them. When he failed to return, they had left their chateau, and had wandered for several years, following vague indications, but without losing hope. So much money had been spent at the tolls of the rivers and in inns, to satisfy the rights of princes and the demands of highwaymen, that now their purse was quite empty, and they were obliged to beg. But what did it matter, since they were about to clasp again their son in their arms? They lauded his happiness in having such a beautiful wife, and did not tire of looking at her and kissing her. The luxuriousness of the apartment astonished them, and the old man, after examining the walls, inquired why they bore the coat of arms of the Emperor of Occitania. "He is my father," she replied. And he marvelled and remembered the prediction of the gypsy, while his wife meditated upon the words the hermit had spoken to her. The glory of their son was undoubtedly only the dawn of eternal splendours, and the old people remained awed while the light from the candelabra on the table fell on them. In the heyday of youth, both had been extremely handsome. The mother had not lost her hair, and bands of snowy whiteness framed her cheeks, and the father, with his stalwart figure and strong beard, looked like a carved image. Julian's wife prevailed upon them not to wait for him. She put them in her bed and closed the curtains, and they both fell asleep. The day broke, and outdoors the little birds began to chirp. Meanwhile, Julian had left the castle grounds and walked nervously through the forest, enjoying the velvety softness of the grass and the balminess of the air. The shadow of the trees fell on the earth. Here and there the moonlight flecked the glades, and Julian feared to advance because he mistook the silvery light for water and the tranquil surface of the pools for grass. A great stillness reigned everywhere, and he failed to see any of the beasts that only a moment ago were prowling around the castle. As he walked on, the woods grew thicker, and the darkness more impenetrable. Warm winds, filled with enervating perfumes, caressed him. He sank into masses of dead leaves, and after a while he leaned against an oak tree to rest and catch his breath. Suddenly, a body blacker than the surrounding darkness sprang from behind a tree. It was a wild boar. Julian did not have time to stretch his bow, and he bewailed the fact as if it were some great misfortune. Presently, having left the woods, he beheld a wolf slinking along a hedge. He aimed an arrow at him. The wolf paused, turned his head, and quietly continued on his way. He trotted along, always keeping at the same distance, pausing now and then to look around, and resuming his flight as soon as an arrow was aimed in his direction. In this way, Julian traversed an apparently endless plain, then sandhills, and at last found himself on a plateau that dominated a great stretch of land. Large flat stones were interspersed among crumbling vaults. Bones and skeletons covered the ground, and here and there some mouldy crosses stood desolate. But presently shapes moved in the darkness of the tombs, and from them came panting, wild-eyed hyenas. They approached him and smelled him, grinning hideously and disclosing their gums. He whipped out his sword, but they scattered in every direction, and continuing their swift, limping gallop, disappeared in a cloud of dust. Sometime afterwards, in a ravine, he encountered a wild bull, with threatening horns, pawing the sand with his hooves. Julian thrust his lance between his dewlaps, but his weapon snapped as if the beast were made of bronze. Then he closed his eyes in anticipation of his death. When he opened them again, the bull had vanished. Then his soul collapsed with shame. Some supernatural power destroyed his strength, and he set out for home through the forest. The woods were a tangle of creeping plants that he had to cut with his sword, and while he was thus engaged, a weasel slid between his feet, a panther jumped over his shoulder, and a serpent wound itself around the ash tree. Among its leaves was a monstrous jackdaw that watched Julian intently, and here and there, between the branches, appeared great fiery sparks, as if the sky were raining all its stars upon the forest. But the sparks were the eyes of wildcats, owls, squirrels, monkeys, and parrots. Julian aimed his arrows at them, but the feathered weapons lighted on the leaves of the trees and looked like white butterflies. He threw stones at them, but the missiles did not strike, and fell to the ground. Then he cursed himself and howled imprecations, and in his rage he could have struck himself. Then all the beasts he had pursued appeared, and formed a narrow circle around him. Some sat on their hindquarters, while others stood at full height, and Julian remained among them, transfixed with terror and absolutely unable to move. By a supreme effort of his willpower, he took a step forward. Those that perched in the trees opened their wings, those that trod the earth moved their limbs, and all accompanied him. The hyenas strode in front of him. The wolf and the wild boar brought up the rear. On his right, the bull swung its head, and on his left, the serpent crawled through the grass, while the panther, arching its back, advanced with velvety footfalls and long strides. Julian walked as slowly as possible, so as not to irritate them, while in the depths of bushes he could distinguish porcupines, foxes, vipers, jackals, and bears. He began to run. The brutes followed him. The serpent hissed. The malodorous beasts frothed at the mouth. The wild boar rubbed his tusks against his heels, and the wolf scratched the palms of his hands with the hairs of his snout. The monkeys pinched him and made faces. The weasel tolled over his feet. A bear knocked his cap off with its huge paw, and the panther disdainfully dropped an arrow it was about to put in its mouth. Irony seemed to incite their sly actions. As they watched him out of the corners of their eyes, they seemed to meditate a plan of revenge, and Julian, who was deafened by the buzzing of the insects, bruised by the wings and tails of the birds, choked by the stench of animal breaths, walked with outstretched arms and closed lids like a blind man, without even the strength to beg for mercy. The crowing of a cock vibrated in the air. Other cocks responded. It was day, and Julian recognized the top of his palace rising above the orange trees. Then, on the edge of a field, he beheld some red partridges fluttering around a stubble field. He unfastened his cloak and threw it over them like a net. When he lifted it, he found only a bird that had been dead a long time and was decaying. This disappointment irritated him more than all the others. The thirst for carnage stirred afresh within him. Animals failing him, he desired to slaughter men. He climbed the three terraces and opened the door with a blow of his fist. But at the foot of the staircase, the memory of his beloved wife softened his heart. No doubt she was asleep, and he would go up and surprise her. Having removed his sandals, he unlocked the door softly and entered. The stained windows dimmed the pale light of dawn. Julian stumbled over some garments lying on the floor, and a little further on he knocked against a table covered with dishes. She must have eaten, he thought, so he advanced cautiously towards the bed, which was concealed by the darkness in the back of the room. When he reached the edge, he leaned over the pillow, where the two heads were resting close together, and stooped to kiss his wife. His mouth encountered a man's beard. He fell back, thinking he'd become crazed. Then he approached the bed again, and his searching fingers discovered some hair which seemed to be very long. In order to convince himself that he was mistaken, he once more passed his hand slowly over the pillow. But this time he was sure that it was a beard, and that a man was there, a man lying beside his wife. Flying into an ungovernable passion, he sprang upon them with his drawn dagger, foaming, stamping, and howling like a wild beast. After a while, he stopped. The corpses, pierced through the heart, had not even moved. He listened attentively to the two death rattles, They were almost alike, and as they grew fainter, another voice coming from far away seemed to continue them. Uncertain at first, this plaintive voice came nearer and nearer, grew louder and louder, and presently he recognized, with a feeling of abject terror, the bellowing of the great black stag. And as he turned, he thought he saw the spectre of his wife standing at the threshold with a light in her hand. The sound of the murder had aroused her. In one glance, she understood what had happened and fled in horror, letting the candle drop from her hand. Julian picked it up. His father and mother lay before him, stretched on their backs, with gaping wounds in their breasts, and their faces, the expression of which was full of tender dignity, seemed to hide what might be an eternal secret. Splashes and blotches of blood were on their white skin, on the bedclothes, on the floor, and on an ivory Christ which hung in the alcove. The scarlet reflection of the stained window, which just then was struck by the sun, lighted up the bloody spots and appeared to scatter them around the whole room. Julian walked towards the corpses, repeating to himself and trying to believe that he was mistaken, that it was not possible, that there are often inexplicable likenesses. At last he bent over to look closely at the old man, and he saw, between the half-closed lids, a dead pupil that scorched him like fire. Then he went over to the other side of the bed where the other corpse lay, but the face was partly hidden by bands of white hair. Julian slipped his finger beneath them and raised the head, holding it at arm's length to study its features, while, with his other hand, he lifted the torch. Drops of blood oozed from the mattress and fell one by one upon the floor. At the close of the day, he appeared before his wife, and in a changed voice commanded her first not to answer him, not to approach him, not even to look at him, and to obey, under the penalty of eternal damnation, every one of his orders, which were irrevocable. The funeral was to be held in accordance with the written instructions he had left on a chair in the death chamber. He left her his castle, his vassals, all his worldly goods, without keeping even his clothes or his sandals, which would be found at the top of the stairs. She had obeyed the will of God in bringing about his crime, and accordingly she must pray for his soul, since henceforth he should cease to exist. The dead were buried sumptuously in the chapel of a monastery, which it took 3 days to reach from the castle. A monk wearing a hood that covered his head followed the procession alone, for nobody dared to speak to him. And during the Mass he lay flat on the floor with his face downward and his arms stretched out at his sides. After the burial he was seen to take to the road leading into the mountains. He looked back several times and finally passed out of sight. End of chapter 2. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Three Short Works by Gustave Flaubert. The Legend of St. Julian the Hospitaller. Chapter 3. The Reparation. He left the country and begged his daily bread on his way. He stretched out his hand to the horsemen he met in the roads, and humbly approached the harvesters in the fields, or else remained motionless in front of the gates of castles, and his face was so sad that he was never turned away. Obeying a spirit of humility, he related his history to all men, and they would flee from him and cross themselves. In villages through which he'd passed before, the good people bolted the doors, threatened him, and threw stones at him as soon as they recognized him. The more charitable ones placed a bowl on the windowsill and closed the shutters in order to avoid seeing him. Repelled and shunned by everyone, he avoided his fellow men and nourished himself with roots and plants, stray fruits and shells which he gathered along the shores. Often, at the bend of a hill, he could perceive a mass of crowded roofs, stone spires, bridges, towers, and narrow streets, from which arose a continual murmur of activity. The desire to mingle with men impelled him to enter the city, but the gross and beastly expression of their faces, the noise of their industries, and the indifference of their remarks chilled his very heart. On holidays, when the cathedral bells rang out at daybreak and filled the people's hearts with gladness, he watched the inhabitants coming out of their dwellings, the dancers in the public squares, the fountains of ale, the damask hangings spread before the houses of princes, and then, when night came, he would peer through the windows at the long tables where families gathered, and where grandparents held little children on their knees. Then sobs would rise in his throat, and he would turn away and go back to his haunts. He gazed with yearning at the colts in the pastures, the birds in their nests, the insects on the flowers, but they all fled from him at his approach, and hid or flew away. So he sought solitude, but the wind brought to his ears sounds resembling death rattles. The tears of the dew reminded him of heavier drops, and every evening the sun would spread blood in the sky, and every night in his dreams he lived over his parricide. He made himself a haircloth lined with iron spikes. On his knees he ascended every hill that was crowned with a chapel, but the unrelenting thought spoiled the splendour of the tabernacles and tortured him in the midst of his penances. He did not rebel against God, who had inflicted his action, but he despaired at the thought that he had committed it. He had such a horror of himself that he took all sorts of risks. He rescued paralytics from fire and children from waves, but the ocean scorned him, and the flames spared him. Time did not allay his torment, which became so intolerable that he resolved to die. One day, while he was stooping over a fountain to judge of its depth, an old man appeared on the other side. He wore a white beard, and his appearance was so lamentable that Julian could not keep back his tears. The old man also was weeping. Without recognizing him, Julian remembered confusedly a face that resembled his. He uttered a cry, for it was his father who stood before him, and he gave up all thought of taking his own life. Thus weighted down by his recollections, he travelled through many countries and arrived at a river which was dangerous because of its violence and the slime that covered its shores, since a long time nobody had ventured to cross it. The bow of an old boat, whose stern was buried in the mud, showed among the reeds. Julian, on examining it closely, found a pair of oars and hit upon the idea of devoting his life to the service of his fellow men. He began by establishing on the bank of the river a sort of road which would enable people to approach the edge of the stream. He broke his nails in his efforts to lift enormous stones which he pressed against the pit of his stomach in order to transport them from one point to another, He slipped in the mud, he sank into it, and several times was on the very brink of death. Then he took to repairing the boat with debris of vessels, and afterwards built himself a hut with putty and trunks of trees. When it became known that a ferry had been established, passengers flocked to it. They hailed him from the opposite side by waving flags, and Julian would jump into the boat and row over. The craft was very heavy, and the people loaded it with all sorts of baggage and beasts of burden, who reared with fright, thereby adding greatly to the confusion. He asked nothing for his trouble. Some gave him leftover victuals which they took from their sacks, or worn-out garments which they could no longer use. The brutal ones hurled curses at him, and when he rebuked them gently, they replied with insults, and he was content to bless them. A little table, a stool, a bed made of dead leaves, and three earthen bowls were all he possessed. Two holes in the wall served as windows. On one side, as far as the eye could see, stretched barren wastes, studded here and there with pools of water, and in front of him flowed the greenish waters of the wide river. In the spring, a putrid odour arose from the damp sod. Then fierce gales lifted clouds of dust that blew everywhere, even settling in the water and in one's mouth. A little later, swarms of mosquitoes appeared, whose buzzing and stinging continued night and day. After that came frightful frosts which communicated a stone-like rigidity to everything and inspired one with an insane desire for meat. Months passed when Julian never saw a human being. He often closed his lids and endeavoured to recall his youth. He beheld the courtyard of a castle, with greyhounds stretched out on a terrace, an armoury filled with valets, and under a bower of vines, a youth with blond curls, sitting between an old man wrapped in furs and a lady with a high cap. Presently the corpses rose before him, and then he would throw himself face downward on his cot and sob, "Oh, poor father, poor mother, poor mother!" and would drop into a fitful slumber in which the terrible visions recurred. One night he thought that someone was calling to him in his sleep. He listened intently, but could hear nothing save the roaring of the waters. But the same voice repeated, "Julian!" It proceeded from the opposite shore, fact which appeared extraordinary to him, considering the breadth of the river. The voice called a third time, "Julian!" and the high-pitched tones sounded like the ringing of a church bell. Having lighted his lantern, he stepped out of his cabin. A frightful storm raged. The darkness was complete, and was illuminated here and there only by the white waves leaping and tumbling. After a moment's hesitation, he untied the rope. The water presently grew smooth, and the boat glided easily to the opposite shore, where a man was waiting. He was wrapped in a torn piece of linen. His face was like a chalk mask, and his eyes were redder than glowing coals. When Julian held up his lantern, he noticed that the stranger was covered with hideous sores. But notwithstanding this, there was in his attitude something like the majesty of a king. As soon as he stepped into the boat, it sank deep into the water, borne downward by his weight. Then it rose again, and Julian began to row. With each stroke of the oars, the force of the waves raised the bow of the boat. The water, which was blacker than ink, ran furiously along the sides. It formed abysses and then mountains over which the boat glided. Then it fell into yawning depths where, buffeted by the wind, it whirled around and around. Julian leaned far forward and, bracing himself with his feet, bent backwards so as to bring his whole strength into play. Hailstones cut his hands, the rain ran down his back, the velocity of the wind suffocated him. He stopped rowing and let the boat drift with the tide, but realizing that an important matter was at stake, a command which could not be disregarded, he picked up the oars again, and the rattling of the tholes mingled with the clamourings of the storm. The little lantern burned in front of him. Sometimes birds fluttered past it and obscured the light, but he could distinguish the eyes of the leper who stood at the stern, as motionless as a column. And the trip lasted a long, long time. When they reached the hut, Julian closed the door and saw the man sit down on the stool. The species of shroud that was wrapped around him had fallen below his loins, and his shoulders and chest and lean arms were hidden under blotches of scaly pustules. Enormous wrinkles crossed his forehead. Like a skeleton, he had a hole instead of a nose, and from his bluish lips came breath which was fetid and as thick as mist. "I am hungry," he said. Julian set before him what he had, a piece of pork and some crusts of coarse bread. After he had devoured them, the table, the bowl, and the handle of the knife bore the same scales that covered his body. Then he said, "I thirst." Julian fetched his jug of water, and when he lifted it, he smelled an aroma that dilated his nostrils and filled his heart with gladness. It was wine. What a boon! But the leper stretched out his arm and emptied the jug at one draught. Then he said, "I am cold." Julian ignited a bundle of ferns that lay in the middle of the hut. The leper approached the fire and, resting on his heels, began to warm himself. His whole frame shook, and he was failing visibly. His eyes grew dull, his sores began to break, and in a faint voice he whispered, "Thy bed!" Julian helped him gently to it, and even laid the sail of his boat over him to keep him warm. The leper tossed and moaned. The corners of his mouth were drawn up over his teeth. An accelerated death rattle shook his chest, and with each one of his aspirations his stomach touched his spine. At last he closed his eyes. "I feel as if ice were in my bones. Lay thyself beside me," he commanded. Julian took off his garments, and then, as naked as on the day he was born, he got into the bed. Against his thigh he could feel the skin of the leper, and it was colder than a serpent and as rough as a file. He tried to encourage the leper, but he only whispered, "Oh, I am about to die. Come closer to me and warm me, not with thy hands, no, with thy whole body." So Julian stretched himself out upon the leper, lay on him, lips to lips, chest to chest. Then the leper clasped him close, and presently his eyes shone like stars. His hair lengthened into sunbeams. The breath of his nostrils had the scent of roses. A cloud of incense rose from the hearth, and the waters began to murmur harmoniously. An abundance of bliss, a superhuman joy, filled the soul of the swooning Julian, while he who clasped him to his breast grew and grew until his head and his feet touched the opposite walls of the cabin. The roof flew up in the air, disclosing the heavens, and Julian ascended into infinity, face to face with our Lord Jesus Christ, who bore him straight to heaven. And this is the story of Saint Julian the Hospitaller, as it is given on the stained glass window of a church in my birthplace. End of Saint Julian the Hospitaller. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Three Short Works by Gustave Flaubert. A Simple Soul. Chapter 1. Félicité. For half a century, the housewives of Pont-l'Évêque had envied Madame Aubin her servant Félicité. For 100 francs a year, she cooked and did the housework, washed, ironed, mended, harnessed the horse, fattened the poultry, made the butter, and remained faithful to her mistress, although the latter was by no means an agreeable person. Madame Aubin had married a comely youth without any money, who died in the beginning of 1809, leaving her with 2 young children and a number of debts. She sold all her property, excepting the farm of Touques and the farm of Geffos, the income of which barely amounted to 5,000 francs. Then she left her house in Saint-Melaine and moved into a less pretentious one, which had belonged to her ancestors and stood back of the marketplace. This house, with its slate-covered roof, was built between a passageway and a narrow street that led to the river. The interior was so unevenly graded that it caused people to stumble. A narrow hall separated the kitchen from the parlour, where Madame Aubin sat all day in a straw armchair near the window. 8 mahogany chairs stood in a row against the white wainscoting. An old piano, standing beneath a barometer, was covered with a pyramid of old books and boxes. On either side of the yellow marble mantelpiece, in Louis XV style, stood a tapestry armchair. The clock represented a temple of Vesta, and the whole room smelled musty, as it was on a lower level than the garden. On the first floor was Madame's bedchamber, a large room papered in a flowered design and containing a portrait of Monsieur, dressed in the costume of a dandy. It communicated with a smaller room, in which there were 2 little cribs, without any mattresses. Next came the parlour, always closed, filled with furniture covered with sheets. Then a hall, which led to the study, where books and papers were piled on the shelves of a bookcase that enclosed 3/4 of the big black desk. 2 panels were entirely hidden under pen and ink sketches, gouache landscapes and Audran engravings, relics of better times and vanished luxury. On the second floor, a garret window lighted Félicité's room, which looked out upon the meadows. She arose at daybreak in order to attend Mass, and she worked without interruption until night. Then, when dinner was over, the dishes cleared away and the door securely locked, she would bury the log under the ashes and fall asleep in front of the hearth, with a rosary in her hand. Nobody could bargain with greater obstinacy, and as for cleanliness, the lustre on her brass saucepans was the envy and despair of other servants. She was most economical, and when she ate, she would gather up crumbs with the tip of her finger, so that nothing should be wasted of the loaf of bread weighing 12 pounds, which was baked especially for her and lasted 3 weeks. Summer and winter she wore a dimity kerchief, fastened in the back with a pin, a cap which concealed her hair, a red skirt, grey stockings, and an apron with a bib like those worn by hospital nurses. Her face was thin, and her voice shrill. When she was 25, she looked 40. After she'd passed 50, Nobody could tell her age. Erect and silent always, she resembled a wooden figure working automatically. Chapter 2. The Heroine. Like every other woman, she had had an affair of the heart. Her father, who was a mason, was killed by falling from a scaffolding. Then her mother died, and her sisters went their separate ways. A farmer took her in, and while she was quite small, let her keep cows in the fields. She was clad in miserable rags, beaten for the slightest offence, and finally dismissed for a theft of 30 sous, which she did not commit. She took service on another farm, where she tended the poultry, and as she was well thought of by her master, her fellow workers soon grew jealous. One evening in August, she was then 18 years old, they persuaded her to accompany them to the fair at Colville. She was immediately dazzled by the noise, the lights in the trees, the brightness of the dresses, the laces and gold crosses, and the crowd of people all hopping at the same time. She was standing modestly at a distance, when presently a young man of well-to-do appearance, who'd been leaning on the pole of a wagon and smoking his pipe, approached her and asked her for a dance. He treated her to cider and cake, bought her a silk shawl, and then, thinking she had guessed his purpose, offered to see her home. When they came to the end of a field, he threw her down brutally, but she grew frightened and screamed, and he walked off. One evening, on the road leading to Beaumont, she came upon a wagon loaded with hay, and when she overtook it, she recognized Théodore. He greeted her calmly, and asked her to forget what had happened between them, as it was all the fault of the drink. She did not know what to reply, and wished to run away. Presently he began to speak of the harvest, and of the notables of the village. His father had left Colville, and bought the farm of Les Écots, so that now they would be neighbours. "Ah!" she exclaimed. He then added that his parents were looking around for a wife for him, but that he himself was not so anxious and preferred to wait for a girl who suited him. She hung her head. He then asked her whether she had ever thought of marrying. She replied smilingly that it was wrong of him to make fun of her. "Oh, no, I'm in earnest," he said, and put his left arm around her waist while they sauntered along. The air was soft, the stars were bright, and the huge load of hay oscillated in front of them, drawn by 4 horses, whose ponderous hooves raised clouds of dust. Without a word from their driver, they turned to the right. He kissed her again, and she went home. The following week, Théodore obtained meetings. They met in yards, behind walls, or under isolated trees. She was not ignorant, as girls of well-to-do families are, for the animals had instructed her, but her reason and her instinct of honour kept her from falling. Her resistance exasperated Theodore's love, and so in order to satisfy it, or perchance ingeniously, he offered to marry her. She would not believe him at first, so he made solemn promises. But in a short time he mentioned a difficulty. The previous year his parents had purchased a substitute for him, but any day he might be drafted, and the prospect of serving in the army alarmed him greatly. To Félicité, this cowardice appeared a proof of his love for her, and her devotion to him grew stronger. When she met him, he would torture her with his fears and his entreaties. At last, he announced that he was going to the prefect himself for information, and would let her know everything on the following Sunday, between 11 o'clock and midnight. When the time drew near, she ran to meet her lover. But instead of Théodore, one of his friends was at the meeting place. he informed her that she would never see her sweetheart again, for, in order to escape the conscription, he had married a rich old woman, Madame Lehousset of Toucques. The poor girl's sorrow was frightful. She threw herself on the ground, she cried and called on the Lord, and wandered around desolately until sunrise. Then she went back to the farm, declared her intention of leaving, and at the end of the month, after she had received her wages, she packed all her belongings in a handkerchief and started for Pont-l'Évêque. In front of the inn, she met a woman wearing a widow's weeds, and upon questioning her, learned that she was looking for a cook. The girl did not know very much, but appeared so willing and so modest in her requirements that Madame Aubin finally said, "Very well, I will give you a trial." And half an hour later, Félicité was installed in her house. At first, she lived in a constant anxiety that was caused by the style of the household and the memory of Monsieur that hovered over everything. Paul and Virginia, the one aged 7 and the other barely 4, seemed made of some precious material. She carried them piggyback and was greatly mortified when Madame Aubin forbade her to kiss them every other minute. But in spite of all this, she was happy. The comfort of her new surroundings had obliterated her sadness. Every Thursday, friends of Madame Aubin dropped in for a game of cards, and it was Félicité's duty to prepare the table and heat the foot warmers. They arrived at exactly 8 o'clock and departed before 11. Every Monday morning, the dealer in second-hand goods, who lived under the alleyway, spread out his wares on the sidewalk. Then the city would be filled with a buzzing of voices in which the neighing of horses, the bleating of lambs, the grunting of pigs could be distinguished, mingled with the sharp sound of wheels on the cobblestones. About 12 o'clock, when the market was in full swing, there appeared at the front door a tall, middle-aged peasant, with a hooked nose and a cap on the back of his head. It was Robelin, the farmer of Geffosses. Shortly afterwards came Liébard, the farmer of Toucques, short, rotund, and ruddy, wearing a grey jacket and spurred boots. Both men brought their landlady either chickens or cheese. Félicité would invariably thwart their ruses, and they held her in great respect. At various times Madame Aubin received a visit from the Marquis de Grémonville, one of her uncles, who was ruined and lived at Falaise on the remainder of his estates. He always came at dinner-time and brought an ugly poodle with him, whose paws soiled the furniture. In spite of his efforts to appear a man of breeding, he even went so far as to raise his hat every time he said, "My deceased father." His habits got the better of him, and he would fill his glass a little too often and relate broad stories. Félicité would show him out very politely and say, "You have had enough for this time, Monsieur de Grémonville, hoping to see you again," and would close the door. She opened it gladly for Monsieur Bourret, a retired lawyer. His bald head and white cravat, the ruffling of his shirt, his flowing brown coat, the manner in which he took his snuff, his whole person, in fact, produced in her the kind of awe which we feel when we see extraordinary persons. As he managed Madame's estates, he spent hours with her in Monsieur's study. He was in constant fear of being compromised, had a great regard for the magistracy, and some pretensions to learning. In order to facilitate the children's studies, he presented them with an engraved geography, which presented various scenes of the world: cannibals with feather headdresses, a gorilla kidnapping a young girl, Arabs in the desert, a whale being harpooned, etc. Paul explained the pictures to Félicité, and in fact, this was her only literary education. The children's studies were under the direction of a poor devil employed at the town hall, who sharpened his pocket-knife on his boots and was famous for his penmanship. When the weather was fine, they went to Jeufosse. The house was built in the centre of the sloping yard, and the sea looked like a grey spot in the distance. Félicité would take slices of cold meat from the lunch basket, and they would sit down and eat in a room next to the dairy. This room was all that remained of a cottage that had been torn down. The dilapidated wallpaper trembled in the draughts. Madame Aubin, overwhelmed by recollections, would hang her head while the children were afraid to open their mouths. Then, "Why don't you go and play?" their mother would say, and they would scamper off. Paul would go to the old barn, catch birds, throw stones into the pond, or pound the trunks of the trees with a stick till they resounded like drums. Virginia would feed the rabbits and run to pick the wild flowers in the fields, and her flying legs would disclose her little embroidered pantalettes. One autumn evening they struck out for home through the meadows. The new moon illumined part of the sky, and a mist hovered like a veil over the sinuosities of the river. Oxen, lying in the pastures, gazed mildly at the passing persons. In the third field, however, several of them got up and surrounded them. "Don't be afraid," cried Félicité, and murmuring a sort of lament, she passed her hand over the back of the nearest ox. He turned away, and the others followed. But when they came to the next pasture, they heard frightful bellowing. It was a bull, which was hidden from them by the fog. He advanced towards the two women, and Madame Aubin prepared to flee for her life. "No, no, not so fast," warned Félicité. Still they hurried on, for they could hear the noisy breathing of the bull close behind them. His hoofs pounded the grass like hammers, and presently he began to gallop. Félicité turned round and threw patches of grass in his eyes. He hung his head, shook his horns, and bellowed with fury. Madame Aubin and the children, huddled at the end of the field, were trying to jump over the ditch. Félicité continued to back before the bull, blinding him with dirt, while she shouted to them to make haste. Madame Aubin finally slid into the ditch, after shoving first Virginia and then Paul into it, and though she stumbled several times, she managed, by dint of courage, to climb the other side of it. The bull had driven Félicité up against a fence. The foam from his muzzle flew in her face, and in another minute he would have disemboweled her. She had just time to slip between two bars, and the huge animal, thwarted, paused. For years this occurrence was a topic of conversation in Pont-l'Évêque, but Félicité took no credit to herself, and probably never knew that she had been heroic. Virginia occupied her thoughts solely, for the shock she had sustained gave her a nervous affection, and the physician, Monsieur Poupart, prescribed the salt-water bathing at Trouville. In those days Trouville was not greatly patronised. Madame Aubin gathered information, consulted Bourret, and made preparations as if they were going on an extended trip. The baggage was sent the day before in Liébard's cart. On the following morning he brought around two horses, one of which had a woman's saddle with a velveteen back to it, while on the crupper of the other was a rolled shawl that was to be used for a seat. Madame Aubin mounted the second horse, behind Liébard. Félicité took charge of the little girl, and Paul rode Monsieur Le Chaptois' donkey, which had been lent for the occasion, on the condition that they should be careful of it. The road was so bad that it took 2 hours to cover the 8 miles. The two horses sank knee-deep into the mud and stumbled into ditches. Sometimes they had to jump over them. In certain places Liébard's mare stopped abruptly. He waited patiently till she started again, and talked of the people whose estates bordered the road, adding his own moral reflections to the outline of their histories. Thus, when they were passing through Touques, and came to some windows draped with nasturtiums, he shrugged his shoulders and said, "There's a woman, Madame Lehousset, who, instead of taking a young man..." Félicité could not catch what followed. the horses began to trot, the donkey to gallop, and they turned into a lane. Then a gate swung open. Two farmhands appeared, and they all dismounted at the very threshold of the farmhouse. Mother Liébard, when she caught sight of her mistress, was lavish with joyful demonstrations. She got up a lunch which comprised a leg of mutton, tripe, sausages, a chicken fricassee, sweet cider, a fruit tart, and some preserved prunes. Then, to all this, the good woman added polite remarks about Madame, who appeared to be in better health, Mademoiselle, who had grown to be superb, and Paul, who'd become singularly sturdy. She spoke also of their deceased grandparents, whom the Liébards had known, for they had been in the service of the family for several generations. Like its owners, the farm had an ancient appearance. The beams of the ceiling were mouldy, the walls black with smoke, and the windows grey with dust. The oak sideboard was filled with all sorts of utensils, plates, pitchers, tin bowls, wolf traps. The children laughed when they saw a huge syringe. There was not a tree in the yard that did not have mushrooms growing round its foot, or a bunch of mistletoe hanging in its branches. Several of the trees had been blown down, but they'd started to grow in the middle, and all were laden with quantities of apples. The thatched roofs, which were of unequal thickness, looked like brown velvet and could resist the fiercest gales. But the wagon shed was fast crumbling to ruins. Madame Aubin said that she would attend to it, and then gave orders to have the horses saddled. It took another 30 minutes to reach Trouville. The little caravan dismounted in order to pass Les Écores, a cliff that overhangs the bay, and a few minutes later, at the end of the dock, they entered the yard of the Golden Lamb, an inn kept by Mother David. During the first few days, Virginia felt stronger, owing to the change of air and the action of the sea baths. She took them in her little chemise, as she had no bathing suit, and afterwards her nurse dressed her in the cabin of a customs officer, which was used for that purpose by other bathers. In the afternoon they would take the donkey and go to the Roche Noire, near Hennequeville. The path led at first through undulating grounds, and thence to a plateau, where pastures and tilled fields alternated. At the edge of the road, mingling with the brambles, grew holly bushes, and here and there stood large dead trees whose branches traced zigzags upon the blue sky. Ordinarily they rested in a field facing the ocean, with Deauville on their left and Havre on their right. The sea glittered brightly in the sun, and was as smooth as a mirror, and so calm that they could scarcely distinguish its murmur. Sparrows chirped joyfully, and the immense canopy of heaven spread over it all. Madame Aubin brought out her sewing, and Virginia amused herself by braiding reeds. Félicité wove lavender blossoms, while Paul was bored and wished to go home. Sometimes they crossed the Touques in a boat, and started to hunt for seashells. The outgoing tide exposed starfish and sea urchins, and the children tried to catch the flakes of foam which the wind blew away. The sleepy waves, lapping the sand, unfurled themselves along the shore that extended as far as the eye could see, but where land began it was limited by the downs which separated it from the swamp, a large meadow shaped like a hippodrome. When they went home that way, Trouville, on the slope of a hill below, grew larger and larger as they advanced, and, with all its houses of unequal height, seemed to spread out before them in a sort of giddy confusion. When the heat was too oppressive, they remained in their rooms. The dazzling sunlight cast bars of light between the shutters. Not a sound in the village, not a soul on the sidewalk. This silence intensified the tranquillity of everything. In the distance the hammers of some caulkers pounded the hull of a ship, and the sultry breeze brought them an odour of tar. The principal diversion consisted in watching the return of the fishing smacks. As soon as they passed the beacons, they began to ply to windward. The sails were lowered to 1/3 of the masts, and with their foresails swelled up like balloons, they glided over the waves and anchored in the middle of the harbour. Then they crept up alongside of the dock, and the sailors threw the quivering fish over the side of the boat. A line of carts was waiting for them, and women with white caps sprang forward to receive the baskets and embrace their menfolk. One day, one of them spoke to Félicité, who, after a little while, returned to the house gleefully. She had found one of her sisters, and presently Nastasie Barrette, wife of Leroux, made her appearance, holding an infant in her arms, another child by the hand, while on her left was a little cabin boy, with his hands in his pockets and his cap on his ear. At the end of 15 minutes, Madame Aubin bade her go. They always hung around the kitchen, or approached Félicité when she and the children were out walking. The husband, however, did not show himself. Félicité developed a great fondness for them. She bought them a stove, some shirts, and a blanket. It was evident that they exploited her. Her foolishness annoyed Madame Aubin, who, moreover, did not like the nephew's familiarity, for he called her son thou, and, as Virginia began to cough and the season was over, she decided to return to Pont-l'Évêque. Monsieur Bourret assisted her in the choice of a college. The one at Caen was considered the best, so Paul was sent away and bravely said good-bye to them all, for he was glad to go to live in a house where he would have boy companions. Madame Aubin resigned herself to the separation from her son, because it was unavoidable. Virginia brooded less and less over it. Félicité regretted the noise he made, but soon a new occupation diverted her mind. Beginning from Christmas, she accompanied the little girl to her catechism lesson every day. End of chapter 2.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.